Hey everybody, welcome back to the Damage Report. I'm John Iadarola. It is Wednesday. JR Jackson is back in studio. Welcome back to the show, JR.
Damn, it's JR Wednesday. Did you know?
Did you
realize that?
I mark it on my calendar. Well, technically Google marks it on my calendar. It's a recurring thing, but it is today.
But you tell it to. Full disclosure, this is not a mug full of alcohol this time. What it is
sometimes?
inside baseball. What it is tea because I'm thoroughly sick. So when you hear a couple of cracked voices and maybe prepubescent sounds, it's just that's the problem that's going on today.
Exactly. I just seconds before the broadcast burned my mouth on hot coffee. Here's the thing on Anderson Cooper, Don Lemon, they're just as much of gigantic messes as we are, but we tell you. we do that. Okay, so normally this is the part of the show where I preview everything. There's gonna be a lot of stuff. It's gonna be awesome. We're gonna end with Meanwhile In. With that, let's jump into the news because there's just too much of it. CNN has decided that, God, if they can just hire enough of Trump's favorite people, maybe he'll stop punching them in the face. And so they did that once again this week, hiring a longtime Republican operative, Sarah Isger, as political editor, not just a sort of general political editor, but one who's going to help shape their 2020 campaign coverage starting in the very immediate future. So who is this person? According to a CNN spokesperson, Isger, who recently worked as the Department of Justice's main spokesperson under then Attorney General Jeff Sessions, will coordinate their political coverage on TV and on CNN's website. So this was the messaging person for Jeff Sessions, who was not just a Republican, like a Republican senator and then the AG, but a guy who on some of the most important topics that will be discussed in the 2020 election, issues of race and immigration and criminal justice, is just about as bad as any Republican is. She was the person helping craft and publicize his positions on those issues. And now he's gonna be helping figure out what exactly CNN is gonna be doing. And I wanna give you just a little bit more context. The Washington Post reported that during an early 2017 Oval Office meeting with President Donald Trump, Isger, who was critical of Trump during the 2016 campaign, quote, kowtowed to Trump and pledged loyalty to his agenda as a condition of getting the job as Sessions' spokesperson. So I love that Sessions isn't choosing a spokesperson, Trump is, but also, remember all those talks we had about like James Comey like being faced with a loyalty oath and refusing to do it and all of that? She's the person who took the loyalty oath. She's the person who didn't have the personal integrity or commitment to independence and truth. Remember, this is the DOJ, it's supposed to be independent. She said, yes, whatever you want, Trump, I will give you that.
Maybe
and she's gonna be doing CNN's
so
news.
So apparently this is what CNN is looking for as far as, hey, you know, she doesn't have any principles, even politically. She's not a journalist, but principles politically.
I didn't even mention that. She has no journalistic background whatsoever. She has no experience that would lead. Thank you for mentioning that.
Yeah.
She's not qualified in any way. Her only experience is being a hack for Jeff Sessions and Donald Trump.
Yeah, so CNN's looking, so at least maybe she changes her perspective, because as you said, she was critical of Trump in the 16 campaign. Then once he won, she's totally on board and saying all the same things he likes to hear. So maybe they're okay with someone who changes their perspectives and their approach to politics. So maybe when she comes over to CNN, she'll be straight shooting and actually put it down the line, which is the way CNN likes to portray themselves. They also went for it. CNN was saying the reasons why they did it. Now they said, think, in the past, even before that, she's joining a group of people. Their understanding is she's gonna be joining several political editors who coordinate coverage. She's not gonna be controlling all of it. It's not just gonna be her call. Cool.
Okay, now, good.
Number two, they also went on to say how the reporters are up in arms about it. She doesn't have really any real journalistic experience. And they said, what about people like George Stephanopoulos, who was, of course, worked on Clinton's things back in the day? The difference is he's a host now, 20, 30 years later. And also, this isn't someone who's shaping the programming directly that's associated with the person that he worked with. So this is directly with the 2020 campaign, their coverage from someone that's still running from the previous campaign. So it's not even like her beliefs being Republican is the problem. Problem is your connection to the person who's running.
Yeah, so if CNN all of a sudden just starts talking nonstop about a caravan, Maybe that's why. We won't even know, because it won't even be about the person saying the line. It'll be the person behind the scenes coordinating. What are they going to talk about? What are they not going to talk about? Which candidates will they have on? Which will they not have on? I mean, why have a journalist make those sorts of decisions when you can have someone who worked for Jeff Sessions?
One small thing before you continue, because what a lot of people don't know, in many major newsrooms, people go, oh, there's that host. They think the host knows everything. They think the host writes everything. They think the host has, these are all the host's approach and how they do it. There's a team behind them. There's a direction, and there's a formation of the way the news coverage goes. Obviously, that's what they said she's going to be part of heading. So that's who controls the way the news comes out.
Yeah.
Sorry, continue. You have
and,
a lot to
No, you're right. And look, so a little bit more information on her. First of all, it is entirely possible that, like most of the people who worked for Donald Trump, she might well have an NDA, like, on her dealings with Donald Trump. Like, so if you think, if CNN thinks, oh, well, you know, I mean, this looks really bad. It's totally unethical. It's totally unprofessional. But she has insider information. They might not even have access to that information. Second of all, she is personally, when she's not representing Jeff Sessions, she's a crazy person. So I'm not going to read you a whole bunch of her tweets, but she was cited in a lawsuit as being the point of contact for someone who was helping to spread the Seth Rich conspiracy theory that Hillary Clinton chased someone down and knifed them or something. It was a tragedy that was exploited by a bunch of people. Anyway, she was involved in the process of helping disseminate that conspiracy theory. She also had tweeted at one point that CNN, her eventual employer, was the Clinton News Network. So don't worry, CNN, now that you've brought her on, I'm sure all the right wingers will love you now. And that's my biggest issue here. It's obviously, there's implications for how the 2020 campaign coverage will go on CNN, but it was always gonna be terrible anyway, so I'm not as worried about that. It's that CNN and MSNBC really seem to believe that if they just hire Sarah Isgren, if they bring on Jeffrey Lord, and if they bring on Kayleigh McEnany, and they bring on all these loyalists, then all of a sudden conservatives will love them. That's never, ever, ever going to happen. It is stupid, and even if it wasn't stupid, even if it was true that they would eventually come to your side, that's not your job as a media organization. And it's dumb and not gonna work.
Yeah, best case unethical scenario here is that CNN brought her on as, hey, we brought on this super Republican Trump supporter, Trump campaign person, and they're actually not gonna have her have much shaping in the coverage. Mm-hmm. And it's have her in as like a shadow figure. That's best unethical perspective we can go.
That's best case, that's not good.
Yeah.
Okay, what are the chances that this will stop Donald Trump from calling them fake news? What percentage chance?
Well, I think he did it this morning.
Yeah, I think he might have done it this morning. This is indefensible. What are they thinking? And again, just to add a little bit more context, I know there's a million things we could say about this. Just a couple of weeks ago, from virtually every big media outlet, thousands of journalists were fired. All of a sudden, editors, people who coordinate, reporters, people who write, all of them. It was like journalist apocalypse. Any one of those people could have been hired and would have had more experience, would have done a better job than Sarah Isgren, who instead is taking the job of a real journalist with no call to have that position in the first place. It is pathetic in every way that it could be pathetic. Now, moving on, more on the media. Donald Trump is at it again, encouraging violence against the media, but not just all of the media in a general sense. That would be bad enough. No, he is targeting an individual media outlet for retribution from one of his deranged followers, tweeting, "The New York Times reporting is false. They're a true enemy of the people." And so the New York Times now has been labeled by the president as your enemy. And so if you're one of his followers who, you know, has been told this for years and you got an arsenal of weapons and all of that, I mean, what do you do to your enemy? How do you respond to a person who is your enemy, who is going out of their way to lie about your God-given president? Hopefully we won't find out. I mean, we probably will, because there's been threats against any number of other organizations that he has personally attacked, including bomb threats at CNN. One of his followers sent pipe bombs to a ton of organizations, specifically because he had been targeting them. So if you're at the New York Times, I empathize with you. I would be terrified. I would be out of my mind scared right now from the direct threat against the New York Times. And so thankfully people have been responding to that. AOC tweeted, "While the right keeps screeching on calling everything socialism, as nations with universal healthcare and better work standards enjoy better health and work life than Americans, they happily cheer on an authoritarian president and defend the destruction of American democracy." The New York Times publisher A.G. Sulzberger responded saying, the phrase enemy of the people is not just false, it's dangerous. It has an ugly history of being wielded by dictators and tyrants who sought to control public information. And it is particularly reckless coming from someone whose office gives him broad powers to fight or imprison the nation's enemies. As I have repeatedly told President Trump face to face, there are mounting signs that this incendiary rhetoric is encouraging threats and violence against journalists at home and abroad. And that is 100% true.
I don't know how soon we forget these things. Actually, I do. As you talk about the pipe bombs and then the threats to CNN and things like that. Somehow it's continued to let, maybe it's not letting him off the hook, because as you said, there's some instances. But it should be across the scale, broad rejection of this type of rhetoric. Mm-hmm. Fox News should be coming out saying again, because there was a few the last time this went through, they said, you know what, we do need to tone down this rhetoric. It should be immediate and swift to where he's ashamed to do stuff like this. But the problem is, we forget enough. His entire life, he's been able to get away with doing the same thing he's always done and getting a slap on the wrist. If that, and moving on and doing it again. An indication that a newspaper's reporting is probably accurate is when Donald Trump goes nuclear and starts telling you to go attack.
Yeah.
That's probably a good indication that what they've said has really gotten to him. He's like, they're really close now.
Yeah.
Let me go and hit my Twitter fingers and find a way to shift this back towards them, because my rabid supporters are my livelihood here.
Yeah. Yeah, and sort of perversely, it's like a boy who cried fake news thing. Let's say that the New York Times did purposefully report something false. How would we ever know? Donald Trump would attack it as false, but he does that all the time when it's true.
Yeah.
We would have no way of knowing. And so why is he doing this? Well, there was a lot of negative reporting in the New York Times and out of it, but specifically in the New York Times, we found out yesterday that he dispatched the acting attorney general, Matthew Whitaker, to try to put a loyalist in charge of the Southern District of New York investigation of him paying off women to hush them up during the 2016 campaign. If that reporting is true, 100% obstruction of justice, obviously, clearly obstruction of justice. That's why he's worried about it. And he's worried about that investigation too, because he doesn't have some of the protections from that investigation that he does from presumably the Mueller investigation. You also had, they tried to oust the independent watchdog in the Department of Education because she was making sure that an investigation of Betsy DeVos wasn't derailed. So again, that's less clearly obstruction of justice, but clearly corrupt for him to be doing that. We also found out yesterday that he's trying to set up a series of nuclear power plants in Saudi Arabia, which might literally break the law for nuclear proliferation. So it was a big day in the news for the president. All those stories will definitely stick around. We'll definitely learn more about those soon. But yeah, this is absolutely terrible. If I was the New York Times, I would be so worried right now. And if something does happen, like, I understand the right is gonna leap to his defense and imply that he had nothing to do with it. But is he not setting the stage for it right now?
The only way you can, I'm sorry, run over it, but the only way you can believe this type of stuff is to also have the mindset that you should do something about it. Mm-hmm. You give a laundry list of things that have been accurately reported about what this president has done in the past and recent past and current. And you, man, if the news made all this up, this is rabid crazy, like the country's upside down.
Yeah.
They make all this up to that degree. Mm-hmm. And if you really believe that, you think, hey, it's all over, might as well start shooting. I mean, that's the way the thought process has to go for someone like that.
Watch our video of how many Trump supporters have more faith in InfoWars than the New York Times. So it apparently is working. I will close by saying, I wanna tie this in with my ongoing effort to make sure that people have more civic knowledge. And so a little bit of constitutional homework. We should occasionally look over the Constitution, learn stuff. I will give you a random section to look up based on this story. We'll go with the 25th Amendment. Look it up, you know, figure out what it's about. Maybe it applies to the situation. We're gonna take a short break. We come back, Ashley Balcerzak will be joining us. We'll be breaking down the fundraising and donors of Senator Elizabeth Warren after this.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
In our continuing series, Following the Money, for all of the declared Democratic candidates in this primary cycle, we're joined once again by Ashley Balcerzak of the Center for Public Integrity to talk about Senator Elizabeth Warren and who exactly is fundraising for her. Ashley, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Always good to have you here. So today, Senator Elizabeth Warren, I want to hit some of the same points so we can do sort of direct comparison as with some of the other candidates we've talked about. But overall, her fundraising prowess, her ability to pull in money in her elections, how has she done?
She's really ranking among the top of most of the Democrats that have come up. She has among the most cash on hand, so she has about $11 million in her bank account right now. And besides Bernie, Bernie Sanders has both a presidential account and a Senate account, and that's like $14 million. She's really high up there. She has a ton of small donor support. So almost half of, I think actually more than half of her money is coming from donations under $200. And that's a pretty high percentage. It's like below only Bernie Sanders again and Kamala Harris. So she's pretty high up there.
There's a couple things you raised, points you raised there that I want to address. But were you saying that Kamala Harris has higher than a 50% small donor contribution?
Yeah, she has like 75%. She has a really insanely high amount of small donors.
You learn something new every day. So thank you for that. I do want to just mention one thing because you talked about Bernie Sanders. We're actually going to have another reporter on to talk about that next week. But I did see, I want to acknowledge, in the first day since he launched his presidency, he's raised $6 million, which I mean, I'm not, you know, a historian in, you know, campaign finance, but that sounds like that stands out as quite a bit for a one-day haul. Does that sound about right?
I mean, that does really seem insane. So that's what his campaign is saying. We can't verify this with campaign records yet, but I don't see why the campaign would want to lie. But compared to Elizabeth Warren, for instance, her first day, so she had just announced an exploratory committee in December, which is not the same as saying, "I have announced yet." She did that 2 months later. But during that day, she raised about $300,000, and that we see from FEC records. So to compare that with 6 million to Bernie, that's a huge difference.
Yeah, and we've seen, I know Kamala Harris raised quite a bit of money the day after, Amy Klobuchar raised a good amount, but I think this is leading the pack so far.
Yeah, they raised like a million, I believe. So he's like six times more than them.
So more important, I think, than the sheer amount that's been raised is where exactly it's been coming from. And you already talked about the small donors, which is probably the most important part. But in terms of the different types of businesses, things like that, which organizations tend to be more supportive of Senator Warren and which tend to be more hands off with her?
Yeah, so she's really, really popular with different law firms and women's groups. So Emily's List, people who work for Emily's List and their PAC, they've given her the most amount of money. Her second biggest donation, and this is in her last Senate campaign, was Harvard University, where she was a professor. University of California is also up there. So those are kind of her big ones. It's mostly liberal groups and education, as well as law firms. So kind of people in her sphere. She also raised a lot of money from women. She has gotten at least half or more of her contributions came from women, which is very huge. As we reported, that's kind of like a big donor base that Democrats are trying to tap into and get more donations from.
That's interesting. At least at first glance, that sounds somewhat similar to what we were saying about Amy Klobuchar, that lawyers and women as well were sort of the bigger industries, although perhaps for different reasons between the two candidates. How is she doing with donations from Wall Street?
She was lower. She did get some money from Wall Street. I think it was like around, I don't want to make up a number, but it was in the thousands. And I was like, wow, I'm surprised that anyone would have wanted to give her money there. But yeah, she did get a little bit, but that's small in the, I mean, I think she raised, oh my goodness, how much was it? Like 25 million? No, 35 million in that 6 years. So, I mean, if you're getting a couple thousand, that's not much in the grand scheme of things.
She could probably afford to lose it. So, in a broader view, that her sort of philosophy on campaign finance, in terms of how restrictive is she being in who she will accept money from and what is she allowing?
Yeah, so her website says that she doesn't want PAC money in general. A lot of other candidates, you're seeing them say corporate PACs, and her language on the website is saying just PACs. And in the past, she's gotten quite a bit of money from labor union PACs. So we'll see if she sticks with that. She says that she doesn't want to accept any money from lobbyists as well. So we'll be following along to see if she keeps those promises. She also says she wants to get rid of Citizens United. She wants to get rid of lawmakers that can trade stocks. She doesn't want that to be a thing. She doesn't want lawmakers to then become lobbyists even after they leave at any point. Right now, there's a limit in which you have to wait a couple of years. And she says, no, you should never join a lobbying firm. And she's been calling out different retired lawmakers on Twitter. So that's been interesting and pissing people off. So.
Okay, so and thank you for that too, because of course, as important as it is on how they fundraise their campaign, what they would do to the system if they were to get in, also very important. So as always, Ashley, we appreciate you coming on the show and breaking down Senator Warren's finances.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
We're gonna take a short break. We come back, actually we have some policy from the senator's office, her new universal childcare proposal. And I also saw, this is gonna seem a little bit weird, but I saw a tweet from, I think it was NOAA, it was some climate change data. And I've read the Twitter responses, and now you're gonna have to see some as well after this. I talk often on this show about the progress that we're making on dealing with climate change. In various parts of the world, little changes being made. We're trying to persuade people that this is a threat worth facing. Now the Green New Deal is this big part of the political conversation. But when I talk about the progress we need to make, it's not just like, hey, the oil companies, it's also us. We are stupid primates. That's all that we are. And it's very difficult for us to get us to accept what is abundantly true. So I saw a tweet. It was from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. And they tweeted out just some statistics. It was just in January 2019 was the third warmest January on record for the globe. And they showed you a little map showing where temperatures were average, where they were higher than normal, where they were lower than normal across the world in January. And you take a look at that and you think, well, what's so bad about that? Well, that's not bad, but Twitter added this feature where people can respond, and it's generally been considered to have been a bad decision all around, but it's still there. So I looked at some of the responses, and one guy said, so according to the map, if I take the average of all documented temperatures, then global temperature is average. I thought global warming meant the entire world's average temperature rises. A lot of hype over something that isn't fully understood. Well, he is right at the end. Something's not understood. It's not what you think it is. So he thinks if temperatures anywhere go down, then on average, it's all average. It doesn't matter. That's not true.
So this is why wording had to change for people who when people don't want to pay attention, can we put up the tweet again from the organization about the warmest thing?
So
there's
a map.
Yeah, so there's certain terms that, like, remember they said, oh, you guys had to switch it from global warming to climate change because you knew that it's because you had to make sure people understood. I guess you have to change words so people can listen. So it says 2019 is the third warmest January on record for the globe. So people see the word warmest, and they think it means it has to be summertime, first of all, in their neck of Minnesota.
Yeah, it has to be warmer than it ever is, ever, anywhere.
And so when they think warmest, so if the normal average was 20 degrees, but then it's up to 25, guess what? 25 is warmer than 20. Doesn't mean that it's warm out.
Yeah, I checked his math. He's not wrong.
It's crazy. And also, if you live in Minnesota and it says for the globe, Mm-hmm. Minnesota is not the globe. Mm-hmm. So where you're standing, because you're shoveling snow out of your driveway, does not mean that it's not warm in other parts of the world, or warmer mm-hmm. than it usually is in other parts of the world. Doesn't mean your little 5-second window in this 5-second of January mm-hmm. is indicative of the entire world, an entire history yeah. of the world.
Yeah, that's a point we're going to return to in a second. I want to read more of these tweets.
This is tiring.
So another tweet said, cold water from ice melt will cool the oceans, and cooler seasons in the temperate regions are part of the cycle. The earth is breathing heavy in times of stress, just like humans. No, the earth is not on the verge of orgasm. It's heating up on average. Your metaphors are not applicable to this situation. But another person said, I live in North Dakota and would have never guessed that. That's why you're not in charge of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Scientists are, and they're not just chilling in North Dakota. They're going all over the place. If you believe that you can disprove climate change by being in a cold spot, don't make me broadcast from a hot tub. I'll prove climate change is indisputable.
It's weird. Those astronauts keep talking about space exploration and planets, stars, universe. I've never been there.
Is France real? I've never seen it. Okay, next. Here's a different take. So these people are like, I can disprove it. Not everybody comes at it from that point of view. So another person says, I really don't care. Humans will adapt and survive. It's truly a hoax. So he's just like,
okay.
So, I mean, oceans. What does a house need to be dry? Can it be underwater? We'll figure it out. I don't mind being a dolphin. Another person says, you have to question the data. There aren't enough weather stations to make this claim, and the satellites are more of an estimate than an actual reading. There's no thermometers on satellites that can read ground temperature. That's true. There's not thermometers on satellites because that's not how thermometers work. Thankfully, though, that's not how satellites measure the temperature.
It's like the Earth doesn't even have a tongue. You can stick the thermometer under to check the temperature. Maybe you can stick it in the Earth's anus and then find out the temperature that way.
It refuses to bend over. So how can we really know? Yes, to some extent, some of these are. They've got so many different ways in so many different parts of the world. The important thing is that those measurements are consistent year to year and place to place. And so they are able to be compared between them. Perhaps the lowest effort tweet, though, that frustrated me was this. Oh, okay. Hey, snow, am I right? What I want to know, these people in particular, why are they following the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration? I'm led to believe that they're just responding to everything that they tweet that
yeah,
they don't
they're
like.
Probably not following it. They've never heard of the organization. So what it is that, you know, maybe there's a story that comes out. They read a story online that said, you know, this is a report, and they went and checked it out and said, I'm going to respond to these crazed scientists getting paid tons of money. By the way, I said it before. If you want to read the whole study, which I wouldn't be able to understand, read it. Mm-hmm. Study it. Go through every page of it and see if you can figure out what it all means, since you really want the information. Am I right?
Yeah.
You want the information. You don't want to trust them. Go and review it. Mm-hmm. Write your own.
Go to the headquarters of NOAA. I'm sure they're lonely and would love to give you a tour. Like, they will. Like, go to a university. Talk to climate scientists doing academic research. Like, they would love to talk to you in depth about exactly how they do the measurements, why they know that things are moving in the direction that they are. The thing about this that's so frustrating is not the ignorance, it's the laziness. Because these people are saying, based on their own unwillingness to learn about exactly how this works, that we shouldn't do anything. So it's not just laziness, as bad as laziness can be on a personal level. This is laziness on a global level. It is, I am willing to bet that our civilization will not end, and I don't care to do the research to find out whether that's true or not. That's a big bet. Do your research on that.
It's weird. I mean, you know, there won't be any, you don't want to believe those scientists making mad money off of research. But you are willing to believe that caravans continue to come into our southern border that you still haven't seen.
Yeah.
You're willing to believe that every time.
I keep hearing about caravans, but I'm looking around. I don't see any caravans. Oh, okay. That's not how we know that the caravans are BS. I just want to make that really clear. So I've been thinking a lot over the years about how exactly to persuade people on climate change. I will acknowledge this segment's not the one that'll do it. But I do aim to do that. And so if you have any suggestions, feel free to tweet them at the Damage Report and I will take a look. With that said, let's turn to more policy. Senator Elizabeth Warren is running on bold proposals, and today she's got another one. It has to do with a universal childcare plan that she wants to set up. It's the Universal Child Care and Early Learning Act that would fund a network of federally funded but locally managed daycare centers, preschools, and other childcare facilities. All children would be welcome, and families earning 200% of the federal poverty level or less would pay $0 for their kids to participate. Above that level, families would pay some share of the cost, but even the wealthiest families would have their fees capped at 7% of their income. Now, I have been led to believe that it is generally more than 7% of a family's income to do this as it stands right now. And so to find out more about this, we turn to noted father, J.R. Jackson. J.R., what's it like to have to pay for daycare and childcare? And
it comes to every aspect. I mean, spring break is coming up, and children, for some reason, in this country, get 2 weeks of spring break now. Isn't that crazy?
What?
Isn't that crazy?
I want my extra weeks.
That's crazy. I mean, you know, you can't really, I don't know what's happening. These millennials. I know they're not millennials.
Anyway, less than that.
So you have to think about how much you're gonna pay for these 2 weeks worth. You gotta think how much you pay for summer vacation, camps then, because people, guess what? Majority of Americans also work in the summertime. Mm-hmm. Their jobs continue on straight from June through August. It's crazy how that works.
How expensive are we talking?
Minimum $500 probably a month, I'd say something like that. Mm-hmm. You know, and depends on where you go. If you want to go to, say, like, you know, a church daycares and stuff, it's cheaper, but you have to be willing to allow them to be indoctrinated and all that. So it's, and people do that, that's fine. You know, it's cheaper because they have, you know, the organization of the church under it. But, you know, it's always a question of who you're leaving your kids with. So you vet all these organizations, even if they're not religious funded ones. But then you have to, it's cheaper in us, so it ends up attracting you to do it. Yeah. So I mean preschool and stuff, thousands of dollars a month. It's crazy.
Oh my God. And yeah. So if you think about that,
and we're talking LA. So I mean, I get it's probably higher here than other places.
Presumably wages would be higher. But for any of these people, like if you're at the poverty level or double the poverty level, like what are you supposed to spend more than 50% of your income on childcare? Like, you can't do that. That's crazy. That is literally crazy. And so not just the economic issues that causes, but think about the stress for tens of millions of American families all around that they're constantly having to worry about that because many are just not going to be able to do this. So instead, I'm sure they turn to family or friends or whoever, which is a constant struggle for them to make sure that their kids are actually looked after and that the time that the kids are spending is being spent well. Yeah. This is an opportunity for these kids to be learning and developing and all that. And in many cases, they won't because of economic necessity. So she wants to fix that. Right now, average low-income family is estimated to spend about $1 of every six it earns on childcare. That's a huge percentage there. It is expected that this would cost, considering increased economic output from them, instead putting the money into the local economy, of about $70 billion, which is significantly less than what her wealth tax proposal would bring in every month. So that is good. And by the way, many people will respond to this and all the plans that Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, and others will put forward and say, that is crazy, wild-eyed socialism. Well, maybe it is, but it's not new socialism. Back in 1971, the Comprehensive Child Development Bill was passed by both Democrats and Republicans. That would have set up a national daycare system. It would have if Richard Nixon hadn't vetoed it. And so half a century ago, we could have had this same basic idea. It would have been different in some of the numbers. But Richard Nixon decided that no, that would damage families because if he did that, then women would start to go to work and he didn't want that.
Can't work out that way.
Yeah. And so maybe we can catch up to where we should have been in 1971. That would be awesome. With that, we are going to take a break. When we come back, Scott Morris is going to be joining us, breaking down a company that is helping to coordinate policy between literally thousands of police departments around the country, and what the implications of that are after this. Joining us now on the show to help break down how exactly we end up with the police department policies that we do, Scott Morris, independent journalist. Scott, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Glad to have you here. And I very much enjoyed some of your recent writing in The Appeal about this company, Lexapol, that I honestly had not previously heard about. So for those watching who might also be unfamiliar with Lexapol, who are they and what are they doing?
Yeah, Lexapol is a private company that has been developing police policies since 2003. They've grown pretty quickly in that time. And this point, they are providing policies for around 3,400 police departments, fire departments, and correctional agencies in 35 states. And that's according to them.
And that's amazing. I had no idea that there was a company in that sort of space. But also importantly, while we know that they have many clients, we can't necessarily know individual police departments or fire departments that are working with Lexapol. Is that correct?
Yeah, they won't disclose exactly who their clients are. They call it proprietary information. You can find out if your police department is a Lexapol subscriber, say through a public records request, but to find out the full scope of their reach is impossible.
Okay, interesting. And so in your research, what are some of the implications of having a company like this coordinating policy across many different departments across perhaps the entirety of the United States?
Well, it's true that police departments, it can be difficult to develop policy, particularly for smaller departments. What's interesting about Lexapol is that they build themselves as a company, not only as a time saver, but somebody that can protect you from lawsuits. And so protection from lawsuits necessarily doesn't necessarily have a good, it doesn't necessarily lead to better policing. So for example, if you're sued and something is explicitly forbidden by policy, then a court could find that you're liable in the lawsuit because the officer broke policy. Now, if the policy is more vague and doesn't allow particular or doesn't forbid particular actions, well, that means that the department's not going to be found liable. So you necessarily have a reduced liability in that scenario.
And so I want to get into the area of some of the things that they have been either pushing or encouraging departments on that hypothetically could run afoul of the law or the Constitution. There was one area that I found very interesting, which was them challenging regulations against police officers firing at vehicles, which is something that apparently, according to your reporting, some departments had sort of voluntarily taken those regulations literally decades ago, but now Lexapol is encouraging them to apparently fight against those regulations?
Yeah, so I mean, the NYPD has forbidden officers from firing at moving vehicles in most circumstances since the 1970s. And a few years ago, Task Force on 21st Century Policing that was convened by Barack Obama, one of the recommendations they made was to for officers to make that policy explicit as well, that officers should not fire into moving vehicles. And there's been different best practices efforts to keep officers from doing this. But Lexapol says that, you shouldn't make anything forbidden basically in your policy along those lines, because they argue that at some point an officer, you can't know all the circumstances, and an officer might have to might have a reasonable circumstance to do that. But at the same time, this is something that best practice experts have been recommending departments take for decades, and it's particularly recently. So there's a conflict there between what these police reform experts are saying and what Lexapol is saying.
And as you point out, that sort of practice seems much more geared towards avoiding lawsuits rather than producing more responsible, safer policing.
Exactly.
I'm curious, Lexapol is operating in this space. Do we know of much competition in this same sort of field of helping to craft and coordinate policy, either from private corporations like Lexapol or from either maybe police reform organizations, nonprofits, or anything like that?
Well, there is a lot of nonprofits that'll make model policies available. The ACLU makes model policies available. Campaign Zero is another organization that's making model policies available that is explicitly designed to reduce use of force and killings by police. And there's other private law firms that'll offer these kinds of services, help draft policies, consultants. As far as I know, No one has done this to the scope that Lexapol has. No one is operating as widely.
Interesting. And especially considering, you know, how important that can be, some of the negative responses that can come from that. I want to thank you for doing your reporting in this area and following Lexapol and some of what's coming out of it. So Scott Morris, independent journalist, thank you for joining us on the Damage Report.
Thanks for having me.
We're going to take one more break. When we come back, a little tour of news going on around the world. And meanwhile, in. And now it's time to take a look at what's going on around the world in a segment we call Meanwhile In. Meanwhile, in the Vatican City, it has been revealed that there is apparently a secret set of rules governing what happens when a priest fathers a child, which I probably don't need to tell you is totally against the rules. They're supposed to be celibate. But a Vatican spokesman said, I can confirm that guidelines exist. It is a document for internal use. And the actual specifics of what are inside of it, entirely secret at this point. But it is important because Catholic priests are required to maintain a life of celibacy, refraining from any sexual activity, of which fathering children is, of course, a part. But there's all these sexual abuse scandals, obviously. And so that is starting to make some people think that maybe that policy needs to change. And if they've already been dealing with a bunch of it throughout their history, that might make it a little bit more likely that some sort of reform would actually come.
I'm not sure if they really believe what they're preaching.
I think that there's a chance that that's not the case.
This is less church and more business.
Yeah.
Cover up your tracks.
I get that there's arguments to be made, but it seems like it's sort of going against human nature. And I would say that the sheer number of scandals that have come about imply that the damage that is done seems far surpassing any even hypothetical positives. I've saw one group track down 50,000 children of priests in 175 countries. And apparently, the rules do encourage priests who father children to step down from the priesthood and take care of their children, although I'm sure there's many cases where that does not happen.
The effort that goes into covering up or making sure this doesn't get to where it needs to be as far as information or for everyone to know, I assume it's far greater of an effort than just doing something about it in the first place.
Yeah.
To halt it or maybe have a different approach.
Tradition is powerful. People don't want to change. But meanwhile, in. Meanwhile, in Japan, they apparently nominated Donald Trump for a Nobel Peace Prize. This was revealed last Friday by Trump, who said, I think I can say this. Prime Minister Abe of Japan gave me the most beautiful copy of a letter that he sent to the people who give out a thing called the Nobel Prize. I've never heard of it. Sounds great. He said, I have nominated you, or respectfully, on behalf of Japan, I'm asking them to give you the Nobel Peace Prize. I said, thank you. And I saw this and thought, why are they nominating him for a Nobel Peace Prize? Is it possible that they know something that we don't, that they understand his foreign policy on a deeper level, that they really get how he's trying to benefit the world? Is it possible? No, he asked them to do it, it turns out. Yes, according to sources, the US government asked Tokyo to nominate Trump, which is the saddest thing since a kid in elementary school asking for people to start calling him by a nickname he likes. It is the presidential equivalent of that. Call me T-Bone. This is basically that.
It totally is. And when I first heard it, I was like, oh, I'm going to gloss this over. Because I remember early in the presidency, this guy's presidency, they talked about how foreign leaders, there was like a report out on how to talk to Trump. It says, butter him up, make him think you love him, just overdo it, and he's going to do whatever you want. And I was like, 100%. Man, this is the approach, right? But then it's gotten even worse. That's at least, there's some kind of like scheming involved to get on the good side of the presidency. You can use him whichever way you want to, which also happens. But on top of that, then it goes to him asking for it and then complained after that quote. He complained, Obama got one 15 seconds after being in office. He didn't know what it was here for.
That is the only thing that this is about. It kills Donald Trump that Barack Obama has a Nobel Peace Prize and he doesn't. So he is willing to go to these humiliating lengths of saying, please nominate me for this thing that I have no call for. That is what this is about. But that's going on. There's more going on in Nerdtown. Meanwhile, in. Meanwhile, in France, and this is a fun one, the French Fencing Federation has recognized lightsaber fencing as an official sport. I think we have a shot of it that we can show. And you're seeing there, it looks exactly like you'd expect. And I know what you're thinking. That looks awesome. And you're thinking, why don't we all do this? And that's the thing, I predict that within a year or two we probably will, because that looks really fun. Participants are required to use an illuminated weapon, although they'll have to settle for a blade made of polycarbonate rather than the magnetically contained plasma of the films. While that means that the weapons won't be slicing anyone in half anytime soon, participants will still need to wear masks and armor to protect themselves during matches, or long, awesome robes. And feel free to fight in both darkness and smoke. That'll make it more exciting too.
Is there also a school for this? Is there like,
I think I've heard of
school. There's a fencing school, obviously. There's fencing schools everywhere.
It's like one close to us, actually.
Yeah, is there a school that like teaches people the correct way to lightsaber fight?
Well,
if not, you should open one.
We don't have much time. So the important thing that you know is that there is not one correct way to lightsaber fight. There are actually a number of different lightsaber fighting styles. I think 9. Each having certain advantages. Some are more defensive, some more offensive, some more acrobatic. In future episodes of the Damage Report, I will break down every one of those styles of lightsaber fencing.
I feel like you're making this up.
No, it's true. It's 100% true. It's canon. Look it up. Anyway, that's what's going on around the world. Thank you, JR, for joining us on the show. Always good to have you on.
No, it just ruined it. The day's over.
Nope, sorry.
I'm going home.
I'm going to tell you about them. Vapid's my favorite. Anyway, thank you everybody for watching. We'll be back tomorrow with much more for you. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.